Let's go over to the book of Acts, chapter 18. We'll pick it up with... Oh, I'm supposed to read the question from this week, which I did not grab a bulletin. Actually, I did, but I left it in the sound room. Anybody have one from today? Thanks, Miranda. All right, so question for next week. The Bible question is, the Lord destroys those who speak, dot, dot, dot. So next week, we're going to call on... Oh, wait. We're going to call on Gerald. Oh, you're going to be gone next week. I can't even pick on him next week. All right. Acts chapter 18. Yeah, no doubt. Send me a text. Acts chapter 18. We've been working through Paul's second missionary journeys, of course. Up to this point, we've talked about how when Paul left Corinth, he stopped in Cenchrea and had his hair cut because he was completing a vow. Talked a little bit about last week what that vow may have been. We don't know 100% for certain exactly what that vow was, when he made it, or why he made it. But we'll talk a little bit more about that today, and then probably talk about a couple of other interesting aspects to translation questions that you'll see. So let's get a little bit of a running start here. We're going to start back in verse 12 of Acts chapter 18. We'll read down through verse 22. So Acts chapter 18, beginning in verse 12. But while Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews, with one accord, rose up against Paul and brought him before the judgment seat, saying, "This man persuades men to worship God contrary to the law." But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of wrong or a vicious crime, O Jews, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you. But if there are questions about words and names and your own law, look after it yourselves. I am unwilling to be a judge of these matters." And he drove them away from the judgment seat. And they all took hold of Sosthenes, the leader of the synagogue, and began beating him in front of the judgment seat. But Gallio was not concerned about any of these things. Just stop and pause there for a second. Handle it yourselves. So how do they handle it? With words and wisdom, logic, and reason. Oh, wait, no, they just take him and beat him in the public square. Sosthenes, that's a great answer. Anyway, Paul, verse 18, having remained many days longer, took leave of the brethren and put out to sea for Syria. And with him were Priscilla and Aquila. In Cenchrea, he had his hair cut, for he was keeping a vow. They came to Ephesus, and he left them there. Now he himself entered the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. When they asked him to stay for a longer time, he did not consent. But taking leave of them and saying, "I will return to you again, if God wills," he set sail from Ephesus. When he had landed at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church and went down to Antioch. So we talked a little bit about this last week, discussed a little bit about what the vow may have been, and Donnie had brought up an interesting question. Donnie, you have the Amplified version, right? Okay. Would you mind reading those two verses for me, that 19 and 20? I'll come to you. Yeah, sorry, 18 verses 19 and 20, I think is the one that mentions it.
Yeah, Paul stayed for a while longer and then told the brethren and sisters goodbye and sailed for Syria, and he's accompanied by Priscilla and Aquila. At Cenchrea, he had his hair cut because he was keeping a Nazarite vow of abstention. A Nazarite of abstention is in brackets. Then they arrived at Ephesus.
You can actually stop there. That's fine. So what you'll notice is in some of the... There's a lot of great translations of Scripture out there, and the Amplified Bible is actually a really good one. But what you'll notice is anytime you see something like in brackets or sometimes in italics, depending upon the translations and whatnot, those words are added. And in this case, I'm a little disappointed that they didn't. I think they actually may have some notes in the margins on that. But just be careful when you see stuff like that, when you see brackets, they're making an assumption that it was a Nazarite vow. It probably was in some way, shape, or form, but we don't know 100%. So what you'll see, and then it's interesting, they add actually of abstention at the end of that. Basically, Again, that is a that's an assumption that they're making based upon what the Nazarite vow is about. And as I mentioned last week, you can read quite a bit about the Nazarite vow in Numbers chapter 6 if you're interested. First about 27 verses of that chapter, you'll read quite a bit about the Nazarite vow. But they're making an assumption. So it's a great, the Amplified Bible is a great one, but just for any of you who may not be aware of it, anytime you see brackets or you see italics, or sometimes you'll see stuff in parenthetical statements that are assumed by the translators. And we'll actually talk a little bit more about this in a bit more detail here as we move on, because there's actually a really interesting point about translators and what we can call the initial texts, or the early copies of the New Testament. And we'll talk a little bit about those real quickly. So let's chat about the city of Ephesus. I'm not going to get into a whole lot of detail on Ephesus right now, okay? Because we're going to talk about it when we start the third missionary journey. So we'll just leave it for that right now. But the thing I do want to point out here, if we go back to our text here, verse 19, they came to Ephesus and he left them there. So Paul leaves Aquila and Priscilla in Ephesus. They would actually stay there for some time, and they would make some disciples, as was their habit, as was their occupation. Their time in Ephesus would also provide valuable insight for Paul when he returns to the city. So Aquila and Priscilla stay in Ephesus when Paul continues back to Syria, Antioch specifically, but he leaves Priscilla and Aquila there. Now consider the value that these guys, the valuable information that these guys would be able to provide for Paul when he gets back to continue his journey, to continue his missionary efforts. They're going to have a better idea of the layout of the city. They're going to have probably a place to stay. They're probably already have some great contacts. It's a great opportunity for Paul to seed some work there so that when he comes back, he can hit the ground running. Paul, as was mentioned there in verse 19, now he himself entered the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. He spent a short amount of time in Ephesus. He reasoned with the Jews in the synagogue, and they wanted him to stay longer. But Paul did not. But he expressed his desire to return, as he says, if God wills. Now, verses 21 and 22, what we see here, and we'll read these real quickly again, but taking leave of them and saying, I will return to you again, if God wills, he set sail from Ephesus. When he had landed at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church and went down to Antioch. Now, Paul was seemingly anxious to return to Antioch, as evidenced by his quick departure, okay? And he was wanting to sail directly to Caesarea. If you look at a map, if you have a map of the second missionary journey, and you look at where Paul went after he left Cenchrea, what you'll notice is that he does not travel over land to return to Syria, or Jerusalem is where he goes first. Instead, he hops on a ship, a boat, a waterborne vessel of some sort, and beelines it back. Okay? Now, we don't know why, but what you'll notice, how many of you have a King James Version or a New King James that you read on a regular basis? Okay. Would you mind reading those couple of verses for me, please? Let me make sure that it actually has it in the translation.
This is a new one.
Okay.
Not the original.
Yeah, would you read verse 21, please?
But took leave of them, saying, I must by all means keep this coming feast in Jerusalem, but I will return again to you, God willing. And he sailed from Ephesus.
So you notice something that's added there? Anybody catch that? Okay. Yeah. He actually, the King James Version, and the New King James, they insert a phrase in those verses indicating that Paul was in haste to observe a coming feast in Jerusalem. They are assuming that it's Passover. That's in verse 21. So the way that the King James says it, it says, "But bade them farewell, saying, I must by all means keep this feast that cometh in Jerusalem." Let's go back to the New American Standard for just a second. "But taking leave of them and saying, I will return to you again." But taking leave of them and saying, he says, I got to go. I'll come back to you if God wills. King James Version says, "I must by all means keep the feast that cometh in Jerusalem." New King James says the same thing, "but took leave of them saying, I must by all means keep this coming feast in Jerusalem. But I will return again to you, God willing," and he sailed from Ephesus. So, most of your King James Versions New King James Versions, they're not going to put those in parentheticals. They're not going to put them in brackets. It's just inserted in the text. So, why? Anybody know why? Well, it deals a little bit with what I had discussed with Donnie after the class, actually. And that is, it's based on the text, they're called text types, from which New Testament translations were originally made. Most other literal translations do not contain this insertion that we've talked about. Okay, New American Standard, ESV, Rotherham's, most of the, like we're talking like 90% of the other translations do not include that text, that insert. So, the King James Version was based on Erasmus's work from the 9th century, which was based on the Byzantine text types. There are three primary text types. There's Alexandrian, Byzantine, and Western text types. Okay? These are basically the earliest copies of the New Testament manuscripts that were collected from various areas. Okay? And I'll talk about more about those here in just a moment. So, the Byzantine text types, which Erasmus based his work on, which the King James Version was based on, they encompass the surviving copies of the New Testament found around modern Turkey, Greece, and the Middle East. That's why they're called the Byzantine texts. Okay? They were written on vellum, which is a much more durable medium than papyri. Okay? So vellum was essentially an animal skin. So one of the reasons that we have so many copies of the Byzantine texts is because they were written on vellum. They were written on animal skin, as opposed to many of the others that were written on papyri. They date, now this is important, they date from the 9th century onward. Okay? So 9th century is 900 years, okay? Well, technically it's 800 years. So it's several hundred years removed from the original things that they recorded. The Byzantine text type contains the most copies by far. So when you begin to look at the original text translations of the New Testament, the Byzantine texts have the highest number of copies, because they were written on vellum. However, the vast majority of English translations, the NAS, the Rotherhams, the Holman Christian Standard, the ERV, the ESV, the NIV, etc., they are based on the more authoritative Alexandrian text type. The Alexandrian text type encompasses the earliest surviving copies from the early 2nd and possibly 1st century. Okay, so I had pointed out that the Byzantine texts were from the 9th century. The Alexandrian texts are from the 1st and 2nd century. It's early 2nd century and possibly into the 1st. You know, when you start crossing the line between say 1999 and 2000, It's a little difficult to nail it down exactly, especially when you're looking at something that happened several, you know, 100 years ago. So when you look at it from the perspective of from the first century to the second, and we're looking at it from 2,000 years ago, it's a little difficult to nail it down. The point being that the Alexandrian texts, while they are not the most numerous, they are considered the most authoritative. They encompass texts from primarily North Africa. So if you know where Alexandria was, it's on the southern shore of the Mediterranean Sea, or on the northern shore, if you will, of Africa. Okay? The Alexandrian text types were written on papyri, which is why we don't have as many of them. But they are considered by most experts to be the oldest form of the New Testament and the most authoritative. So it illustrates the method of relying on records written closer to the events that are recorded. Now, all of that being said, I'm not the other ones, the Western texts, and those are the ones that are essentially around Rome. We're just not going to worry too much about those for right now. So, why this insertion? I'll give you my opinion, and it's my opinion, 100%. Love to hear your thoughts if you have any on it. But this is my opinion, okay? So, what I tend to believe is that Paul was anxious to return and report to the brethren more so than a desire to go to Jerusalem. And this is because there is no record of Paul taking part in the Passover feast at this point. Only a brief reference in Acts chapter 18, verse 22, of him going up to Jerusalem. Okay? And you don't even see it directly. So let's go back to verse 22. He says, when he had landed at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church. And from this, we can assume that he went to Jerusalem. Anybody know why we can assume he went to Jerusalem based on this verse? Okay, well, where the church started. Kendall, you had something? The key is in the text.
I'm guessing because he went up to greet the church and then he went down to Antioch.
Okay, can you explain that a little bit more?
Whenever they talked about Jerusalem, they always talk about going up.
And why is that?
Because it was on a mountain.
It was on a higher elevation. Yep. That's basically the conclusion that we can draw. And from that very point, the elevation in Jerusalem from sea level to the city itself was about 2,500 feet above sea level. So when he landed, excuse me, a frog in my throat this morning. When he landed, verse 22, when he landed at Caesarea, so he lands at Caesarea and then he goes up 2,500 feet to Jerusalem and then he goes back down to Antioch, okay? That's why we can assume that he went to Jerusalem. However, in that one verse, there is no mention of him partaking in the Passover or in any feast. And it seems to be a very brief visit while he's there. He went up, greeted the church, and went down to Antioch. It's just a quick stop, and then he continued on. No mention of it in the verse that he partook in any feast or did anything else other than basically greet the church. So, the other side of this, as to why I think that particular thing was inserted, is really it deals with the issue of, I guess, what we can call Calvinism, what we can call premillennialism, a desire to continue to put Jerusalem at the center of what we'll call, quote-unquote, Christian worship. I believe it was added as a way to validate premillennial doctrine that was recognized as early as the Council of Nicaea in AD 325. So I believe that the translator added that because he again wanted to put the focus on the city of Jerusalem. Now, anybody hear of the Crusades? What were they trying to do in the Crusades? I mean, what's if you could encapsulate it into one thing, what were they trying to do? What's that? They're trying to recapture Jerusalem. Now, of course, the Crusades happened much later than 325, but this is really where the roots of it started. Because Constantine placed tremendous value on the city of Jerusalem. And this is an example of that. Okay? That's why it was, in my opinion, that's why it was added. Anybody have any other thoughts or additions on that? Of course the preacher's got something to say. Mr. Toole.
I'd probably give you more if I was sitting a little closer to the front, but well, it's like you said, we can't know for sure, but I don't think the Lord's against us reasoning our way through sections like this, as long as we hold them in the realm that they are in, which is a little bit of conjecture. Mm-hmm. But I would agree with that. On a couple ideas, I mean, you see that focus in the first missionary journey, that when they return is to give the church in Antioch a report. And it seems to be the focus here. It's like it's a up-down illusion, and then the focus was Antioch. So, you know, I mean, you can kind of see that. And then, you know, we know brethren in other countries, and Lord willing, Benoit will be here in a week or two. You know, and those guys in the past have been able to stay for peaks and family camp and for assemblies, and you know, they usually have a plan, you know, and when it's time to head home, they head home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just because something comes up along the way, you know, they might try to make time for it or sneak it in. And, I mean, there's usually a plan, right? Mm-hmm. And once they've come and went where they wanted to go, it's like they head home. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the report's to be given in Antioch. So that's where they would want to go. Mm-hmm. So that's also why I would tend to agree with that. And then also Acts chapter 20. I mean, we're reading Acts 18, and all I can hear in my head is the verbiage in Acts 20. How, again, Ephesus gets skipped, okay? Only in Acts 20, the Spirit is clear that Paul's desire is to get to Jerusalem in that case, mm-hmm. right? And so he skips Ephesus, just calls the boys down to Miletus and says, hey, let's have a quick little get-together here. And he hops on that boat and just cruises all the rest of the way to the port to get to Jerusalem. And then the Spirit said in that chapter, in Acts 20, that his desire was to be okay, there for the feast. So it's like if that was the focus, then Luke and the Spirit would have made it, I believe, more clear in Acts 18.
Yep. Yep, and that's, we'll cover that in a lot more detail when we talk about Paul's third missionary journey and his eventual arrival in Jerusalem. But the whole point of these is that what we see of Paul's pattern is to return to the city of Antioch and make a report. Okay. And that is ultimately why I believe that Paul was doing what he was doing. I believe that's why Paul continued on, stopped quickly in Jerusalem, and then went down to Syria. Any other questions or comments? Is that pretty clear? Any confusion we need to clear up? Johnny.
Can you explain why he would or wouldn't participate in the Passover feast?
Why he would or wouldn't? Because
yeah.
He chose not to, or he chose to.
Yeah. Why?
Okay. So the reason that he probably didn't in this case is because he wanted to get back to Antioch.
Yeah.
The reason that he does in Acts chapter 20.
So it wasn't important to him. Then.
It wasn't the focus. No. No. So that's a good way of putting it. It wasn't as important to him as making sure he reports to the church in Antioch. And what we'll see in Acts chapter 20, the reason he does participate in Acts chapter 20 in the feast and so on and so forth is to try to basically curry some favor and tell the Jews, hey, I'm not against you. I'm just trying to help you. So, yeah, it was up to him.
Either I missed it, excuse me, or there is no mention of it in 18
about being the time of the year for the Passover feast.
That's a good point. No mention of that.
There could be a good reason why he didn't stop for the Passover if it's not that time of the year.
Yeah. So that's another good point. Yeah, no indication of what time of year necessarily. Okay. All righty. So let's wrap up this section, and then we're going to start a little bit of a review today. Do we have any more updates on whether or not Benoit and Rebecca are actually going to be able to come?
I asked Larry on Wednesday, and he said because they hold their citizenship that they're supposed to be able to exit the country and make it.
Okay.
It sounds like the country itself is on a pretty big lockdown, but there's, I guess, a lot of hope that because they're actually American citizens that they are allowed to leave.
So, okay.
Okay.
Well, we'll continue on, assuming that they'll be here. And if not, well, we'll get her taken care of. All right. So let's wrap up the second missionary journey. There's a whole lot that happened in this particular journey. There's a lot that we've talked about. And we're going to get into a little bit of the review today as well. But on the second missionary journey, Paul was able to encourage churches like those in Syria, Cilicia, Derbe, Lystra, Iconium, Antioch. He established some churches like those in Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, Athens, and Corinth. And it was a journey that saw the beginning of long-lasting relationships. Paul will continue to spend a lot of time with people like Silas and Timothy. Obviously, Timothy he'll write some letters to later on. The physician Luke becomes an important part of Paul's journeys and really an important major contributor to the New Testament. I mean, really, I'm so thankful for Luke. He makes great friends with builds a great relationship with the brethren at Philippi. There's a few people that are specifically mentioned, such as Clement, Euodia, and Syntyche. And then Aquila and Priscilla, of course. Again, these guys really are the powerhouse couple, if you will. These guys really understood, and they knew, and they were fervent for the Lord. Also, of course, he's developed some strong connections with the folks, the brethren at Corinth, including Gaius, Crispus, and the household of Stephanus. And this is a journey that provides much historical background on the New Testament. This particular one, if you notice, I mean, the first missionary journey, there was a significant amount of new works and a lot of persecutions that had followed and a lot of places and not a lot of time. In this particular one, Paul still travels in a lot of places, but he spends more time there. We have a great set of much detail here. This one also describes churches to whom letters were written later, Galatians, Philippians, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, and 1st and 2nd Corinthians. He introduced this particular missionary journey, introduces key people whose impacts are felt in the New Testament. Luke, again, as I mentioned, wrote the gospel that bears his name and the book of Acts. And then Timothy, of course, to whom he writes two epistles, and Silas as well. It was a journey also with several notable examples of conversion. Lydia, the Philippian jailer, the Corinthians, etc. Some folks mentioned in Athens and so on and so forth. We also saw the worthy example of the Bereans and how they listened to Paul and searched the scriptures daily. You know, that hopefully the examples that we've learned from this help to encourage us. So, with that, as is my preference, I like to go through and do a little bit of a review of what we've covered so far and see what you guys know and maybe see what I needed to teach better on and so on and so forth. So let's jump into a little bit of the review. I did not send these because I didn't want him to cheat. He's like, come on over here. All right. So let's work through some of the general questions that we may have covered in the first portion of the second missionary journey. So in what chapter of the book of Acts does the second missionary journey begin? You can look in your Bibles if you want. I mean, most of the time, Yeah. And I'm just going to have you pretty much, for the most part, just raise your hand and I'll call on you and then you can just yell it out. Anybody? Acts chapter 15. All right. So, I needed to get my... Oh, well, I don't have it. From which city did they depart? This should be easy. Which city did Paul always depart from? Dave? Which one?
Syria.
Yep, Syria and Antioch. And what? Anybody remember the name of the other one? Yep, Pisidian Antioch. It's up north and a little bit further west. So, here's a question that you should all remember. Who did Paul leave behind in Antioch? I mean, besides the, you know, all the people that didn't travel with him. Somebody besides Will. Super Dave, I know you got it too. No? He was a guy that had traveled with them on the first missionary journey. He was a really encouraging fella. Yeah, I saw a bunch of you mouth Barnabas. Yeah, so he leaves behind Barnabas in Antioch. Somebody had said John. He did not leave John necessarily in Antioch. We don't know that John was in Antioch when they were leaving. The assumption is that John had gone back to Jerusalem, but we don't know that. Okay, so why? Why did he leave Barnabas in Antioch? I know Will's got it. Barnabas just wasn't up for the challenge, right? He was tired. He's like, man, we just left. We just got back. Want to hang out? Eat some bonbons. Anybody? Go ahead and yell it out. Yep. They argued about whether or not they should take John. They left John. Or why? Okay. They had a disagreement. Remember what the word, how the scripture describes that disagreement? Sharp. There arose such a sharp disagreement between them, right? And the disagreement was about whether or not they should bring John Mark. Well, what? Why? What was the big deal with John Mark? Go ahead and yell it out, Will.
He abandoned him.
Yep, he abandoned him during the first journey for whatever reason, and we don't know what that reason was. We put some conjecture out there. We don't know what the reason was, but John Mark decided at some point. He didn't want to go anymore. He didn't want to continue on. It was in the city of Perga in Pamphylia. So, anybody remember from where Barnabas, or what happened with Barnabas after this? Yep, John Mark went with him. Anybody remember where they went? Went back to Cyprus, right? They go back to the island of Cyprus, and we don't really hear much from either one of them until later on. We really don't hear much from Barnabas at all, or much about Barnabas at all. John Mark we do eventually hear some more about, but not a lot. And so, who did Paul bring with him instead? Guy who spent some time in prison with him in Philippi, right? Silas, right. So, here's one. What brought Silas to Antioch? This one's a little harder. Why was Silas in Antioch in the first place? Dave? Nope. Yeah. Mr. Toole. Bingo. Remember that letter that was written in Acts chapter 15? That was such a big deal about, you know, not eating meat sacrificed to idols and abstaining from sexual immorality and that whole thing about circumcision. He was one of the two guys that had been sent from Jerusalem to Antioch to deliver the letter. So that's what brought Silas, and I'm sure the hand of the Lord had something to do with that. That's what brought Silas to Antioch. So, we know Barnabas and John Mark, they went across the sea to Cyprus. Okay? Which way, this is a map question, Which way did Paul and Silas go from Antioch? What's that? Yeah, went and initially they went immediately north. Okay, so if you look at your map, you can see that Barnabas and John Mark, they kind of head across the sea to the west. Paul and Silas, they go north, and then of course they'll wrap around, but they go north. Why did they go north? Was it just because they didn't want to have anything to do with Barnabas? Man, he's going that way. I don't want to be anywhere near him. No. Okay, they were traveling by land and not by sea. Well, why didn't they go south? Okay, so Kevin's answer is that they were going back strengthening the churches, which, of course, that was certainly part of it. But I think the immediate reason that they went north was because that letter that they were carrying was addressed to them. Okay, let's go back to Acts chapter 15. Verse 23, well, let's take verse 22 for some lead-in context. It says, "Then it seemed good to the apostles and the elders and the whole church to choose men from among them to send to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas, Judas called Barsabbas, and Silas, leading men from among the brethren. And they sent this letter by them, the apostles and brethren who are elders, to the brethren in Antioch and Syria and Cilicia, who are from the Gentiles, greetings." So this letter that had been written from the apostles and the elders in Jerusalem that was addressed to Antioch was also addressed to the churches directly north of them. So that was part of the reason that Paul and Silas went north. It was so that they could deliver the letter that was addressed partly to them. Who did Paul meet in Lystra? Yep, Timothy. Thanks, Dave. It was Timothy, okay? So, tell me a little bit about Timothy. Let's discuss that a little bit. What's a little unique about Timothy? Will, I appreciate you raising your hand every time. I know you know. You and I covered this class years ago, right, with Dr. Dave. I think Uncle Dave was there, too, for a while. But anyway, what was unique about Timothy?
Half-breed.
Yeah. He's a half-breed. His father was a Greek. His mother was a Jewess. And grandma, yes. Okay. So, this young man, Timothy, he's well spoken of by all of those in the area. And we talked a little bit about this, but, well, That's too off the cuff. We'll just continue on with my notes. All right. So, to whom does Paul partially credit Timothy's faith? Will, go ahead. And his mother. Anybody remember their names? Yeah, Eunice and Lois. His mother and his grandmother. Now, let's go over to 2 Timothy chapter 1. Verse 5, Paul's writing to Timothy. He says, "For I am mindful of the sincere faith within you, which first dwelt in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and I am sure that it is in you as well." As a little bit of a side note, ladies, you have a huge impact on your children's faith. Huge. Huge. That was my best Donald Trump impersonation. It was awful. Ladies, you have a huge, huge influence on your children's faith. And Lois and Eunice are a great example of that. So, Timothy was an interesting situation. There was another gentleman who had traveled with Paul, and specifically in reference to his trip to Jerusalem, by the name of Titus. So Titus and Timothy are two guys that are often used to compare and contrast Paul's approach to specific requirements of the Jewish law. Anybody know why? Besides Will. What was unique about Timothy? He was a half-Jew, right? Was Titus a Jew or a Gentile? He was a Gentile. Okay? What was the issue in Acts chapter 15 with the letter that was being written? What was the primary issue, the driving issue? Circumcision. So remember when Titus and Paul, they travel, and Barnabas, they travel down to Jerusalem, and Titus is like, sign me up. I'll get circumcised. And Paul's like, yeah, go ahead. No, that's not what he did. I saw his look. He looks on his look on his face. He's like, no, he didn't. Better cut that. Paul did not allow Titus to be circumcised. But what does he do with Timothy? Okay, why? Oh, because Paul's bipolar. That's the answers I've heard before. You read biblical critics, and some of them actually hold that belief that Paul was bipolar. But what's the difference? Somebody besides Dave and Will. Why? I mean, Titus really wanted, he was convinced that he should be circumcised. But Paul's like, no. Timothy was half Jew, and he had him circumcised. Was it because of Timothy's Jewish heritage that, oh, you know, for you, because you're a Jew, you really need to be circumcised to make sure that you're saved? No. We talked quite a bit about this. But the reason was, is that, remember what was happening with the Judaizers in Acts chapter 15. They were claiming that unless you were circumcised, you were not saved. That's what they were claiming. And it was for that very reason that Paul was like, no, this has nothing to do with salvation. That's why he didn't allow Titus to be circumcised. Because the Judaizers claimed that you needed to be circumcised in order to be saved. And that was a complete violation of the Scripture, of the New Testament. Paul writes to the Galatians about that subject, right? He says, I am amazed that you have so quickly deserted him who called you for a different gospel, right? But with Timothy's case, why did he allow him to be circumcised? Kevin?
The Jews in that area, because they knew his dad was a Greek. So to be more effective, he said, let's do this so that it's not a stumbling block for them.
Right. So you remember Paul, when he would first go into a city or an area, where would he go first? He'd find a synagogue. Now, Timothy, remember, he was well spoken of by all the Jews in the area, right? Or at least to all the church and others in the area. He had a good reputation. But they knew that his father was a Greek. He was not going to be able to be as influential in reaching out to the Jews with the gospel if he had not been circumcised. Timothy fully understood that salvation had nothing to do with circumcision. Fully understood it. So Paul, in order to make him as useful as possible, had him circumcised. And then, of course, took him with him. All right. I think we'll stop there. So next week, we're going to continue on this same path. We're going to work through some more of those review questions. If you have an opportunity, you might want to read back through a few of these chapters just to get a bit more familiar with them. But if it makes you feel any better, I have over 40 questions so far, and I haven't even gotten out of Philippi yet. So I got lots of questions. And these things are important because I want you to be able to answer the questions if they come up. I'm not just trying to, you know, hammer on you, but I want you to be able to kind of answer these questions when they come up, because you're going to get them. You know, if you're leading a Bible study, you're going to get questions like this, especially from somebody who's read the Scripture a few times. So, all right. Thank you for your kind attention. You are dismissed.